outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Wayne, two miracles in 2 weeks.
Two miracles in 2 weeks. That's outstanding.
Yeah, absolutely. So you shared about your miracle golf.
Oh, you
experience.
Didn't have to. You're going to piggyback on mine.
I am going to piggyback on yours.
Okay, so that's the two. So we got one, the hole in one.
So you lived the other one, the hole in one, right?
Okay.
I experienced my first shooting competition that I walked away from saying, I'm never doing that again.
Is this guns or arrows?
Guns.
Oh, long rifle, pistol?
Long rifle. And I've always enjoyed shooting sports and participating in them and enjoying them.
Killing God's creatures. Yeah, I know.
I mean, if it's going to put food on my table, then yes. And so this was one of those experiences where I was really excited, got a babysitter, went to go enjoy this experience with some community of guys that I normally shoot with, got there. And it was so outside of what I enjoy doing. It was hilarious. Like, we were shooting targets. They're about the size of your thumbnail at 50 feet, standing up, holding the gun with no braces and seeing who could be the most steady shooting at these little tiny targets for 3 hours. So not my cup of tea. Never doing that again.
Is this healed you from all shooting or just that kind of shooting?
Just that kind of shooting.
Oh, yep. Well, seriously.
There hasn't been a full conversion.
I'm not sure I'd call it a miracle. That's kind of an anti-miracle.
There was one limitation put on your ability to enjoy shooting sports, huh?
Because my hole-in-one didn't negate my desire to play golf again.
True, but you did say that is now your norm for you have to get a hole-in-one or you just don't feel satisfied with your game anymore.
Yeah, I say that to you in private.
Which you can cut out if you need to.
No, I don't care. I was kidding. I played golf since then. Didn't get a hole in one. Had a great afternoon. So nice. Met some new guys. And
I love you playing golf again. Like that, it genuinely warms my heart because I know how much you enjoy the sport and the ability for you not to be able to do that. Like, it definitely makes me smile thinking that you're playing golf again. Oh, and for you to get a hole in one again. That's
again,
amazing.
One's enough. One's all
one's
I got.
Enough. Okay.
One's all I got. But if I get another one, I'll scream loud enough you can hear it. In
Wyoming.
Anyway, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
Welcome to this edition of The God Journey. Anyway, got a best thing you heard this week.
I do. So this week, I was actually sitting in a class this morning, got invited to be a part of a guest speaker situation. So a clinical PhD in psychology has been a practitioner in the area for a very long time. And they came and they were speaking with our nursing students on building a bridge between the physical Western medical perspective on providing care and mental health treatment. Okay. And how those two things are inseparable. You cannot, especially in modern healthcare, we cannot separate the difference between physical care and psychological care. So one of the things that came up in the midst of that, though, was she referenced Carl Jung. So Carl Jung was a theorist and a big name in the theoretical counseling world.
Yep.
And he said this. She quoted this. This doctor quoted this, and I had to go and do the research on it. Carl Jung said that we operate in a level of understanding, so prefrontal brain consciousness.
Okay.
Roughly.
You're very technical now.
Sorry. Okay. So living in our front brain, right? So not fight, freeze, fawn, not all the like stress response stuff, anything like that.
Our cognitive functions.
Yes.
Okay.
So we're operating in our conscious cognitive function less than 5% of the time we are awake.
Really? That's just the normal person?
So she presents this and I was like, there is no freaking way. I don't agree with that. Like, I don't know. Like, but I went back in. Carl Jung did say that. He did try to propose that in his theory. Whether I agree with it or not, I don't know still. But it led to a really intriguing idea, though, because what she was talking about is when we are not connected to our body And when we do not do the work on our central nervous system, on our subconscious, when we're not taking the time to make sure that that those spaces in our life are healthy, that we are going to operate and do things and get activated by things in the day to day that we have no idea why we're responding that way, what's going on, what's happening. And so her emphasis on that was that people do things all the time without any understanding of why they do what they do. And if Carl Jung's right, then only 5% of the time or less, we're aware of why we're doing what we're doing and what's actually activating that and what's actually triggering that. And that gave me a major pause for thought, because whether that be in our spiritual journey or in relationships or in connection to community, what does that mean? Like, especially if that translates to miscommunication or misunderstanding of the person, oof, that is a small window to be able to try to be seen and connected and heard and valued for who you are, which is a deep human need. It is, I would say, one of the core human needs. And if we only had the capacity to do that roughly 5% of the time, that's a little unnerving to me.
I'm not sure the comment was we had the capacity to, it's just that we don't do it more than that.
Correct. Yes. We have capacity for more. Yes.
Having lived with someone now for the last 4 years, watching when the survival brain kicks in.
Yeah.
I'd be a hard statistic for me to get my head around. 5% of the time, really? Because when it kicks in, it's pretty graphic. If it's fight, flight, or survive, or fight, flight, or freeze, or whatever, that's a pretty big deal. I heard the stat years ago, like 5% of the time, the person you're talking with is actually in the moment with you, instead of being worried about something in their past, having anxiety from stuff back there, or worried about the future coming, or thinking about the next appointment they have while they're talking to you. They're not really in the moment. And the more I've looked at that one, I'm going, I think that's probably true.
Most people, I would agree with that one more. Yes.
Most people don't live in the present. Just even when they're alone during the day, they're always worrying about what's coming, or they're regretting something in their past, and they just can't be present in the moment.
No, I would be in much more alignment with what you just said than I would be with the lack of conscious awareness for more than 5% of the time. Like that, yeah. I have a hard time getting on board with that. I wanted to challenge her in that, but I was like, this isn't about me. That's not my class. Why I'm here. Like, this isn't my class. So yeah, I can probably just pipe down and think about it later.
Part of what you're saying here with this that might be true would be, when you in a circumstance situation, you get away from it, and you go, I don't know why I did what I did. That would be a great thing to do. I don't know. What percent of your week do you say, do you come out of a situation going, ooh, boy, I don't know why I did that?
Oh, man. It wouldn't be nearly 95%. I would say there would definitely be, I would say 20, 25% really? Of the interactions where I'm consciously aware of, that was a weird response, or I wonder what was going on under the surface there. I would say that occurs 25 to 30% of the time that I have interactions with people.
I was thinking about it while you were talking, and I was like, I think it's been like 2 times per week.
Really?
I rarely go away from somebody going, I don't know why I did that. Even if what I did, I look back and I go, I wish I hadn't done that, but I can tell you why I did that at the moment, even if it wasn't the best choice to make. But I, that's weird. I know Sarah coming out of the trauma stuff. And by the way, we had a little talk this morning that was really sweet, because I'm just saying, we don't talk about this a lot in our walks anymore. The coping stuff. Is that because it's getting better? And she said, yeah, I think it is getting better. Mm. And I just go, that's sweet, because we're not dealing with a lot of coping stuff. But having watched a brain function there, then to have the freedom to just know, hey, I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. It may not be right, may not be the best, but... Which leads me to the best thing I heard this week.
Ooh, okay.
Because it's right in the same wheelhouse.
Okay.
This is from Richard Rohr in The Tears of Things, a book that Sarah and I are reading with some of the neighbors near us here. We're reading it, talking about it every few weeks together. He said, remember, every time God forgives sin, he is saying that relationships matter more than his own rules. Think about that. Forgiveness honors disorder, while still naming it disorder. And in the context of the book, he's talking about how disorder is but I would mostly use the word chaos, the chaos of the fallen age. Yeah. So there's disorder, And God wants to bring, God wants to reorder our lives, more complicated than that, but basically to save time here. And I was thinking, boy, every time God forgives, he says his rules are less important than relationship, which is a profound thought, because it is. Mm. And if we're going to forgive other people who say silly things, hurt us, whatever, that's what we would be honoring too. I honor the relationship more than I honor my expectations being met or social propriety or any of those other kinds of things that go along. So, but forgiveness does it without excusing it, without not with that, still identifying it as disorder.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not a great way to live. That's hurtful. But when I forgive, when I let it go, then I'm saying that the relationship is more important than the performance, which is God's heart. And it's just beautiful.
I love that. The fact that you would look at a system and say the relationships are more important than the rules of that system or, you know, the chaos. I think about the situation that's going on in the Twin Cities right now. And we were looking at the, not to get super political, but we were looking at the video feed in my crisis intervention class of the situation and what occurred. And there was nothing relational or honoring about that video. I've been in some very stressful and life-threatening situations where it was unnerving and I wasn't sure where we were going to go with this. But when you honor their humanity, it doesn't look like what I viewed in that video. Like, I don't know what was going on. I don't know all the details, and I'm not going to say that I know all the details. And this was very like disruptive for me because I have lots of friends in the military and in law enforcement. My default has always been to err on the side of giving the benefit of the doubt to law enforcement that they were in the right. And this was the first time that I watched a video and genuinely was like, I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I can give them the benefit of the doubt that this was an appropriate use of force in this situation. That was very disruptive for me. But when I'm watching someone who is not even a part of the hold or the restraint take out their pistol, flip it around, and start pistol whipping the person in the head, that is not honoring to humanity at all. I don't care what situation you're in. I mean, like, that person was not in an active life and death situation where they were about to get killed by this individual. This individual was on the ground with four other people on top of them, and a person is standing in front of them, beating them in the head with a pistol.
And how it's been defended on both sides is just bizarre.
And without, that's the challenging thing, is without pausing and saying, okay, something happened here. We're going to collect the facts. We're going to do an investigation. We're going like,
no, we're going to spin narratives. Both sides. Yeah,
exactly.
Spin narratives.
We're just going to spin it.
Yeah.
We're going to jump ahead and we're going to try to shape the narrative instead of saying we are going to gain facts and we're going to come back to you and present those facts to you. And then we can discuss the narrative.
Yeah. This may cost Christy Noem her job. It might, just by the way she responded to it, but not that the other people on the other side have been any more helpful.
Yeah.
I thought about when I was watching some of that, we've talked about the book, My Grandmother's Hands, about unsettling people. And then when you unsettle them and you put unsettled people in the same environment, it's a disaster waiting to happen.
Correct.
From whatever side. And people aren't thinking well in those environments. And one of the things he talks about in police bodies, the trauma of police bodies and having the power and protection and all that goes along with that is what he calls the annihilation response, which under threat, they just start striking out and, you know, why would shoot somebody 10 times, 15 times, 20 times? He calls it the annihilation response. It's not cognitive. It's not thinking through, I need 15 bullets to down this person or 10.
Yeah.
It's just, I have to annihilate everything threatening me at the moment. And boy, we got to take that seriously with police departments and whatever else. People have to have training, mental health, they deal with stuff that, and that's what he is arguing for in the book, that you get that annihilation response out of law enforcement. So yeah, they got to make split second decisions. And yes, correct, they got to do things in the benefit of people. But when an annihilation response is triggered, and that's always later in the course of, which I don't know what I did. I was scared for my life. And so
correct,
acted out, which is, you know, Not just cops. Normal people do that. Scared for their absolutely. Life. They just, yeah. It's hurtful stuff.
Yeah.
But every time God forgives sin, he's saying relationships matter more than his own rules. Mm. And yet to be able to forgive, I love this, able to forgive and still not, his response is always, it's okay.
Correct.
Like when I say, yeah, Sarah and I are learning, because I had to say, I'm sorry to Sarah about something, particularly if it was triggering her at some point. And I would say, I'm sorry. It's okay. I would say, it's not okay, but it can be. Thank you. I appreciate you saying so. And then she's learning to say that, which is a much better response than, yeah, it's okay. That's not okay. That's why I'm asking. And I love that God forgives without excusing and without, you know, saying it doesn't matter. Go ahead and do whatever you want to do to each other, because I'm just going to keep forgiving you. So I love that. Hey, I thought we'd cover some mail. You want to do that?
Okay.
We got some good mail here of late from people. And this is from Cindy, podcast 1014. Now, I don't know how far we are from that, but this is back ways. Okay. You and Kyle did in December, entitled Murmurations of the Bride, described an experience, described my experience since leaving the 2x2 fellowship. I'm actually going to be in Southern California this weekend with a whole group of folks from this former 2x2 bunch. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
But she goes on, the interactions I've been having with fellow believers outside of any religious setting feels unlike anything I've ever experienced inside the religious setting. It's like you and Kyle described, a sense of constant connection or instant connection with total strangers that we encounter in the most unexpected places. I have heard you make reference to the church that Jesus is building in the world. And now when people ask me what church I'm a part of, that's what I tell them. That always leads to a deeper conversation, and that's when the magic happens. I like that. I think we all leave the conversation aware that we had the privilege of being part of something orchestrated by God himself. I can hardly take it in. When I left the group I had been part of all my life, I didn't know what was next. Wayne, thank you for helping see the church through different lenses. I'm going into this new year without trepidation, without a planned agenda. I'm looking forward to what God has to show me.
Ooh, that sounds like a great way to start the year.
Yeah, isn't it?
Man.
I love that. When people think, man, if I jump out of this thing, what if there's nothing out there for me? And then I just, and then to hear from people saying, you know what, living more relaxed and watching for things that God orchestrates around me is better than trying to fulfill that need through some kind of system.
Mm.
And we're not against systems. Those of you that got systems and you try and honor God in them, I get it.
Correct.
But I think the whole joy of finding this unmanaged connections and fellowship that God gives us, unmanaged by humanity, is pretty cool.
Well, and that's the thing. I would agree. Like, I think that the church that Jesus is building in the world intersects with Sunday morning gatherings and structure and quote unquote Christian institutions or organizations. The church that God is that Jesus is building in the world intersects with those at times and is living in the midst of those at times, but not exclusively and not the default, unfortunately.
Yeah, the reason I wrote Beyond Sundays was for people to say, no matter how you're engaging God and his community, if it's fruitful for you, great. Don't be down on somebody else who's found a different way to do that. I think more likely people outside of it are more generous with people inside than people inside are generous with those outside. Because if you're outside, you're an independent, non-connected, blah, blah, blah. And the accusations run rampant. But I think people on the outside just say, hey, if you're finding people and fellowship there and teaching and instruction that's encouraging your faith and trust and joy, then go for it. But if you're outside of that, if you had enough teaching in your life to last a million lifetimes, go out and experience the reality of community that can just happen, whether it's a conversation or two or in your neighborhood or whatever. Enjoy it that way, which is also really fun. Lori from Canada sent this, desire. I've always been aware of this desire never being quenched feeling for some reason. Remember we talked about the wanting to get something more important than actually having the something.
It's
the
dopamine. Yeah.
When my kids were very little in the 1990s, I saw a pattern emerge with the McDonald's toys received in their so-called Happy Meal. Later, I began calling it the Sad Meal. They would want the newest toy so badly, seeing it advertised between cartoons on TV. We'd get the toy, and within a week, they'd see the next most amazing toy in the lineup and have to have it. The previous toy is now in a pile under the bed. Sigh. I started having a conversation with them about what was happening. Did they notice how they felt when they got the toy as opposed to the wanting of the toy? I call it the McDonald's toy syndrome. The old dopamine hit predates social media, I see.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Social media just tapped into something that already existed.
Yes. And then Lindsay from Canada, where to find relational community? Number 993. This is way back. And it was more about what we were just talking about, how we find community in the world, more what Cindy wrote about. She said, wow, light bulbs going off all over the place. I have totally had an agenda with creating community. All my good intentions are being exposed while I listen to this. It's so good. Very good. It's hard to have relationships when you've got expectations and even your good intentions. You're driving an agenda, then it's just not going to be the same thing.
I still think back to that conversation because I have to be intentional to come back and say, I'm not playing those games. That I want to make sure that I'm here, I'm present. Lord, what opportunities are you giving me in the day? How do I be here in the here and now? Because there's that natural gravitation towards, okay, I'm going to build this, or I'm going to create this community, or I'm going to facilitate this opportunity, or I'm going to really intentionally connect with this person this year. And it's like, but what if that person doesn't want to intentionally connect with you? And there's a couple other people that really do, but they're not on your radar because you're hyper-focused in this one direction. And that's, man, that is just coming back to, I'm not playing that game, Lord. What do you have in the here and now? I want to be present here and I want to see who's around me.
Yeah, I love that. I hear that now at times from the Holy Spirit, checking my yuck meter at times, because particularly with some of the stuff coming at you these days, if you have a self-published book, the people coming at you from algorithms and Manipulate Listopia and Amazon and all this other, and just, oh, it's just so much. And I was contemplating all that, whether I should be doing more, whether I should be doing this. And I just felt that whisper of the Spirit said, you want to go back to playing this game? Oh my gosh. No, I don't. Yeah. I think about that with religious games I used to play, or popularity games, celebrity social media games. I did that same thing. You want to get back playing this game? And I'm going, no, I haven't played this game for 35 years. Why would I want to get back playing those games again? Particularly at this stage of my life.
Well, it's so funny because I've had three different encounters with that exact statement or idea, and it's come in three different tiers. I had a very like blunt college student experience where somebody was talking about trying to overcome their fear and really wrestling with that. And their solution was they will literally flip up their middle finger in the middle of whatever situation they're in and say, F off fear. I'm not playing that game. And then one person was talking.
A little graphic for the God journey there.
It was a little graphic. It's definitely on the more mature content side of things.
Kids don't practice this behavior at home.
Without parent supervision. Oh my gosh. And then there was another conversation that I had with somebody that was talking about fear. And they're like, man, I'm tired of the hamster wheel. And they were talking about fear. And so again, that idea of not playing that game. And then I was watching a movie with my daughters yesterday, and it was the movie Luca, and they're talking about fear and how fear can cut us out from the things that life opportunities that we can have to be able to really experience wholehearted life. And so their solution was Silencio Bruno was their solution of not playing with fear. And they had nicknamed Fear Bruno. And so they would just scream Silencio Bruno as they're doing these different events or experiences. And I love that.
No, let's not play that game. Let's
not play that game.
So many games our world plays: relational games, religious games, celebrity games, social media games. And you can play the game if you want to, but I think the Holy Spirit invites us away. You don't have to play that game. Let me have it. Mike from Ohio wrote this: I'm stuck on the idea of being invited to approach the throne of God and making my requests known. I feel stuck because the only thing I really want to find is a shaded spot, hang out, and soak up being there, to find the rest enough to ask for. I enjoy the moments when I recognize God's presence, which feels like a barometric pressure change in my soul. That's a good description.
Yes.
As we sit and talk, most of our discussions are about his statements of love for me and my inability to understand why he bothers with me. I like laughing with him. I love daydreaming with him and trying to sort out facts and fiction of my experience when doing so. I become dumbfounded as I go through my days, recognize that the only way to explain experience is to acknowledge that they come from his love for me. My first response is why? My most common prayer is, please, thank you. This happens when things enter my mind, and instead of trying to find a way to express, even know my thoughts and feelings, I throw them at him with a, please take care of this, followed by a, thanks for helping me believe you will. I'm constantly praying, please and thank you. I love that because it kind of reflects my journey too in prayer, from the whole manipulating of God thing to try and get what you want to really, it's just thank you for walking through this with me and seeing presence there and not trying to manipulate the response and being relaxed. My most common prayers, please and thank you. That's really good.
I like that. And I think that falls into the don't, I'm not going to play that game anymore either. I mean, that's,
yeah.
Please and thank you, Lord. I love that. I love that approach.
Or what do you have for me as I'm going through this? What's on your heart? What's on your agenda? And then this from Toby, guy I'm working on a book with. They're almost done. Stand by, hopefully next month. He was referring to the Grand Inquisitor that's a part of the Brothers Karamazov, a novel I read actually this fall. But he kind of, after he had that scene available to me, so I reread it, had to focus on it. It said, to have faith is to trust love. Isn't that a great definition of faith?
Oof.
To have faith is to trust love. I wish that was in the book. It's not at the moment. Maybe we'll find a way to get in there. It said, all can love and be loved, even the simplest. Not all can practice theology. So where has God decided to deposit himself? In love. Knowing him is to know love. The problem is that love appears extremely weak to those who have knowledge but have not encountered love. I hear this often from people. You just can't be loving and do this. Man, you got to do right theology. And I got an email just the other day about the same thing. And I went, you know what? If you have not encountered love, if it's just a word to you, that you use like God being nice or kumbaya, or then you don't understand the significant power that love has in our life when we yield to the reality of God's love in us. And so those who thirst after knowledge, it says it seems extremely weak to those who have knowledge but have not encountered love, because they themselves are held together by their knowledge, like an elemental principle of their constitution. They cannot fathom that love is sufficient to do the same. They cannot imagine being free without using knowledge as the means to engineer that freedom. And so that which challenges their knowledge system challenges the core of their identity. To resist it, fight it, and deconstruct it is to survive. I believe the basis of all persecution lies here. Whilst the message of God's love magnifies the worth of the individual beyond anything else, it devalues the worth of the knowledge agent because it renders their mediation unnecessary and obsolete. It levels the playing field. It challenges the view that the church should be governed by intellectuals. Perhaps we have never truly understood the power of the new covenant. Wherever Christ is manifest, the pattern will be the same. Those who desire love will recognize him. And those who desire knowledge will see him as a threat.
There is a lot to unpack in that.
Oh, that's a deeply layered statement of things.
Oh, my gosh.
Particularly if you know the Grand Inquisitor is actually in this Dostoevsky novel, have this conversation between the Inquisitor who's going to kill him and Jesus, who's come to modern day, not modern day, but the Inquisition of back time. And it's this conversation between them and how, you know, we have to kill you. Knowledge, the knowledge is everything. And you're messing with that. And I get that a lot from people. And in fact, somebody got an early view of the Trust Love book because a friend sent it to them with my permission, who's like dean of a Bible college for a denomination then not to be named. And got a 12-page rebuttal back about, particularly on the imputation thing, that's bedrock Protestant theology. It has been for years. Never wrestled with what we actually said. It was just justification means something that we said it meant 500 years ago, that it's the declaration of righteousness, and you've got to have that. And if you don't have that, then you're not saved. And transformation, that's sanctification. That's a whole different thing. And it was just, it was amazing because you read through this 12-page rebuttal, and I know this is the reaction we're going to get from people when the book comes out, because it's just like the people that were on the other side of the shack thing. Love can't be reason enough to walk with God. And I admit, as much as there are intellectuals who kind of get off track because they get lost in their brain, there are people who claim to live in the love of God who don't. They haven't experienced it. It's just love's the theology that sets their heart at comfort. And it's not that they've really engaged love inside the presence of Jesus in their life, because that love changes people. That's just not, oh, I'm loved, so I get into heaven free. And it's just it's not that mamby-pamby thing. God's love for us can walk us through anything the world throws at us. And yeah, we learn to experience it. We learn to lay into that and be settled in it. Yes, that's where I think all growth comes from, right there. How Toby started this, to have faith is to trust love. Hmm. And if you trust knowledge over love, you're going to miss what this is saying. It's not saying that knowledge isn't important or that truth isn't important. And I got this email a couple of days ago too from somebody. Actually, it's a comment on the blog. So he was saying that love is, you know, not enough. A lot of people who claim to be loved who don't walk in the truth, and they have their own truth. And I agree, you can't separate love and truth. You can't separate them. But if you capture love, you'll be able to walk in the truth. Mm. And if you're just trying to walk in truth without love, you're going to find the quote unquote truth that comforts me, which is often isn't truth at all.
Yeah, that I think I'm thinking and reflecting as you read that statement, and the first thing, you know, talking about to have faith is to trust love. We got into a very interesting dialogue today in class with some of my students, and they were processing their strengths, and the dialogue came out of, so why am I able to live out my strengths around people that I don't know? But the people that I'm close to, that I'm relationally connected to, I have a much more difficult time offering my strengths to, or, you know, trusting them with these strengths. And we got into a very interesting dialogue about trusting love and how when we don't experience or don't view love as trustworthy, especially in our early days of developing relationships, that we begin to use our strengths to build safety and protection from the people who are supposed to literally be the examples of love in our life, the initial expressions of love in our life. And we started talking about how when you don't trust love, then you start to build these incredible boundaries around your heart and these walls around your heart, because you don't trust that the people who were supposed to manifest the love of Christ in your life when you first initially came into the world, we don't trust that that's a reality. We don't trust that it's good. And so then thinking about knowledge, you know, I bump into a lot of people that they view love as weakness. They view it as something that they, no, I gotta eradicate this. That is weakness. My strength comes from knowledge. It comes from information. It comes from my physical prowess. Like, those are the things that my strength comes from that I can trust, not love. And it's so, like, I'm really intrigued. I'm going to throw this question out to a couple of my classes of, do you trust love? And see what the response is. Because we talk about it all the time. Even in the counseling world, we are resistant to talking about love, the word love. There's almost this like clinical distancing away from the word love because of all the different connotations that are implied with it. And it's really intriguing to me, because if mental health is distancing itself from the conversation of what love is and being able to experience love and how do you connect with that? I mean, even I watch it even in my classes where I say wholehearted living versus love, because wholehearted living is a lot more tangible and palatable for people than the idea of talking about and trusting love.
Yeah. And as you talk about that, I think in my mind, when I hear to have faith is to trust love, would be to trust the love that God has.
Yes.
It wouldn't be to trust that person's going to love me if they've evidenced the fact that they're going to do what is ever in their self-interest to do, even if that involves stabbing me in the back to get there. And this is why it's difficult for people to trust love, particularly if they've had trauma in their childhood and they have either absent or abusive parents or whatever that hasn't given them a comfort in that love is a great protection.
Yeah.
If you're loved. And to me, when you have God's love, even if I go into a situation where someone else is going to take advantage of me or say something rude or whatever, I don't trust their love. I trust his, that it's big enough to protect me from that. And it's big enough to navigate me through that. It's not love so that bad things will never happen to you. Yeah. It's when something does go awry, I'm here for you. And you don't have to protect yourself with these other things. And so the trusting of love at that level, and yet we throw these words around so casually, right?
Yes.
Particularly love. Oh, I love you, brother. I love you, sister. Right before I drive, I turn around and gossip about you to the next person I'm going to talk to. So it we've learned that love in a human sense is pretty weak. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
But God's love, I think, is the strongest force in the universe. Love opens you to truth. It opens you to what's real. It opens you to see what's alive. And people who diminish love, because, and I like this, and Toby's one of these. Toby's a real intellect. He studies, research. He's got knowledge out his kazoo, and yet he can recognize that if you're constructing a knowledge platform as your form of security, then you're going to devalue love, and you're honestly going to miss it when God comes to visit you with it.
That's, I think about the power of God's love and how encountering that is so vital to being able to navigate this world. Because I think about like my experience when I was really struggling, I'm in that counseling retreat and I got completely like full on head on collision with of the Holy Spirit and the love of Christ. It was radically profound. I felt it in my body. I felt it in my emotions. I felt it in my spirit. It was radically profound. But the challenge is that if what we perceive as being available to us is only the broken and construed ideas of love that we've been shown by people around us, then why would we want to trust love? Why would we want to lean into that? Why would we want to encounter the love of Christ if our preconceived ideas of love are weak, fragile, intangible, not consistent, not enduring? If that's our perception of what love is, then why would we say we need the love of Christ to radically change our life?
Yeah, or if our experience with love, again, has not been concrete, it's not been valuable. We've had every one of us have had people tell you they love us who don't, in fact, love us. They're just saying the words because it sounds good. But when push comes to shove, they're not going to be there for you. They're not going to hold your heart. That's why learning this from Jesus is the most important thing. It's to encounter love, not as a theology or a theological mindset or grace as opposed to works. It's not that. It's actually to let love find its way into your heart. And this is what I wish we had always done with new believers, is to help them discover what love is. The real kind of love that's transforming, that's comforting, that's, boy, it's got me in the midst of the worst thing that happens. What our theology often does is when I'm going through the worst thing I've ever experienced, I feel bereft of God's love because how could God let me go through this and love me? And so everybody jettisons love, particularly God's kind of love, and the worst moment when you need it most.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, to people who say, I've never had this. I know about love intellectually. I know about knowledge intellectually. I want to encounter love, but I've not encountered love. Wayne, what do I do? Kyle, what do I do? How do you help someone encounter love in the space? The kind of love we're talking about, that's tangible and real, not just something in my head, but something that makes my heart. What did Mike say? It's like a barometer in our heart or something.
Yeah, a barometric.
Barometric pressure changes. I feel that exact thing. When we talked about last week about God coming down the hallway or that presence coming.
Yeah.
There are definite changes that come when that awareness rises to the forefront. And again, it's not God capriciously coming and going. He's always present, But there are times where that awareness of presence grows to a place where then there's contentment without a hole in one. There's there's joy. There's even in the midst of uncertain futures and unanswered questions. If we've, and I think this is the mistake we make of God, and we make it of a lot of other people too. I know you love me when you meet my expectations for my life. When you give me what I want, do what I want. And if you don't do what I want, then I know you don't love me because you're not doing what I want. Instead of, no, love's more real than that. It's more a reality that even goes beyond miscommunication, missed expectations. Maybe I want God to take this away and God wants me walking through it. So there's change that goes on in my life. And that's, that encounter with love is so important. And if people are listening to us saying, well, that's never happened for me. Find a space to wait with God. Don't try to make something happen. Don't engineer the moment.
But
keep opening your heart to, Father, would you reveal your love to me? And watch for it as you go about your day and your life. And God begins to let that love be identified. Now, you talk about a very graphic experience at a counseling retreat. It happens sometimes that way. It happens more gradually for other people.
Yeah.
I think what we have to be convinced of is God wants me to know his love more than I want to know it.
Yeah.
Therefore, I can trust his process to bring it to me, not feel like it all hinges on me getting it right.
Man, I would just strongly want to reiterate that. I'm thinking about, I did a trip down to Florida with a group of guys back in November, and I was listening to one of the guys' stories, and they were talking about how they got to this trip. And they were in the middle of their life. They were doing things. They were at a retreat. They were, you know, they were pursuing God. And in the midst of that, there was an opportunity for them to come down and be a part of this trip. And it was a fulfillment of a deep heart dream that they weren't even looking for. And their first response when they got is, would God do this for me? Would God, like, does God care enough? Like, does he genuinely give good gifts? Like, would God do this for me? And that's where I often start with people is, do you know that you are delighted in? And start looking for God's delight in you, in the world around you, in his creation. Start looking for his delight. And that, so I talk about that counseling retreat. What I don't often say is that one of the most powerful expressions of God's love was this individual that came in to be a part of the retreat. When I first met them, I was very resistant to them being there and their approach to me. It was not a blessing. I did not perceive it as love. I perceived it as a threat. And yet, as the time went on, as I started to encounter God's love, I was able to see with a different lens. Oh my gosh, the level of delight that God has in me as his son, as his beloved, that he would set these things in motion that I was able to experience was mind-blowing to me. But it took starting to experience the snapshots of his love to where then I could start to recognize his delight and not just perceive it as a threat.
Yeah, and that's Toby's point, I think, in this email to me, was just how easy things become a threat.
Yeah.
Even love can be a threat to the Pharisee mindset. Love's taking this thing in a place we don't want it to go and that our lives have not been conformed around. And yet trusting love, trusting God's love to be enough to walk me through life. That's a great definition of faith right there. Trusting that love to be enough for whatever it is I'm going through.
Thank you for traveling with us today on the God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.